Hey everyone, you're listening to the Embrace the Messy podcast with Shannon Schinkel. I'm a high school educator, challenge seeker, lifelong learner, and embracer of all things messy. I find inspiration from individuals who are passionate about learning and embracing change. Join me as I share my experiences and interview people who will inspire you to embrace the messy too. Let's go. I was always a pretty good studier when I was in elementary school and high school. I think there was a combination of things. As the daughter and sister of teachers, I think I learned how to study by osmosis. There's just something about being in a teacher family that often makes you a pretty good student. And I just knew how to memorize facts. So now, I was also a big drama nerd, so memorizing a ton of lines also meant that I had to learn a bit and keep adding on and adding on. So I think I organically applied that strategy to studying for tests, especially when I had a lot to memorize and learn. Now, as most of you know, by the time you get into your senior classes, tests shift a little bit and you start having to write more long-form answers, right? Critical thinking questions. Then you have paragraph answers and essay answers. Now, and I loved these kinds of questions because I got to write, which I love to do, and they made us think. I also had a really great History 11 and History 12 teacher. Shout out to Mr. Perrin. Now, you could tell he loved teaching history because he was so passionate about it. And he was funny and sarcastic and like not in this rude way. He was like a comedian, right? He always made us laugh, but we also learned a lot, right? He made the class interesting and fun. And you know what? I didn't even mind writing pages and pages of notes because it was just bloody interesting. But okay, here's my story, right? There's this one time when we had this big unit test. Now, don't ask me what it was on, but I remember preparing and studying very hard, right? And I was ready for the test. I was like, bring it on, Mr. Perrin. I got this. So, like most tests, three sections. Part A, some kind of matching or multiple choice section. Part B, short answer section, right, where you write paragraphs. And then it always culminated in a part C, which was a long form or essay style question, okay? Now, for this test, I blazed through the part A with no problem. And then I put a lot of thought into four short answer questions in part B. I pulled out all the stops and I wrote beautiful paragraphs. But when I got to the last part where I had to write an essay, I only had like 10 minutes left in the class and I couldn't figure out why. So I was perplexed. So, oh my God, I was like, oh my God, right? Okay. You know that feeling like that all of a sudden your heart is sinking and you're freaking out and then you realize you have to stop freaking out because you have to hurry up and freaking write something. So I quickly scribbled as much as I could, knowing full well that for the most important part of the test, I was delivering crap. When we were like a minute away from the bell, Mr. Perrin asked us for our tests. And I was walking up to his desk. I'll never forget this moment. I was, you know, doing like what most students do. They flip through the test to make sure that they've answered every part. And when I looked back at that part B where I had to write the short answers, and you'll remember that I told you that I wrote four beautiful paragraphs. The instructions said, answer two of the four questions. Oh my God. I had misread the instructions and wrote all four short answer questions when I was only supposed to write two. Oh boy. As I approached Mr. Perrin's desk, I thought, okay, this guy is cool. He knows I'm a good student. I will just tell him I screwed up and I'm sure he will cut me some slack on that final question, that essay question, right? He'll see my brilliant four answers in Part B. Now, a few days later, we got our test back. I skimmed Part A, and it was fine. But when I got to Part B, here's what I noticed. I saw 2 marks for the first 2 paragraph answers I wrote. And then, as you can imagine, a terrible mark on my essay. Mr. Perrin marked the first 2 paragraphs I wrote in Part B, skipped the other 2 as if they weren't even there, and then went on to mark the essay. I didn't follow the directions, and he didn't let me get away with it. Yeah, in that moment, standing before Mr. Perrin, I felt the weight of my mistake sink in. I'd flubbed the instructions, and there was no escaping it. But you know what? It was the wake-up call I needed. From then on, I approached every task and every test with a double dose of caution, making sure I never missed a beat on instructions again. So, thanks to Mr. Perrin's tough love, I learned that sometimes the hardest lessons are the ones that stick with you the longest.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. You can find out more at teachbetter.com/podcasts. Now let's get back to the episode.
Patrice Bain is a veteran K-12 teacher in Illinois, and she's passionate about student success using research-based strategies. She is the author of several publications, including the amazing Powerful Teaching, which she co-wrote with Pooja Agarwal, which is the focus of this conversation. Patrice frequently presents professional development workshops throughout the United States. She has taught education courses at the graduate level, and she was a finalist for Illinois Teacher of the Year and a Fulbright Scholar in Russia. Now listen, if you are wondering where you can find strategies to help your students study, and I'm talking about strategies that are simple and accessible, that will help you, your students learn whatever you're teaching, this next hour is going to be some of the best professional development. So grab a paper and pen, because you're going to want to write some of this stuff down. Let's go to my conversation with Patrice Bain. Patrice Bain, welcome to the Embrace the Messy podcast.
I am absolutely delighted to be here, Shannon. Thank you so much for asking me.
I am a huge fan of the book that you wrote with Miss Agarwal, Powerful Teaching. Absolutely love it. I was huge into brain science already, right? I'd been reading, you know, Make It Stick and Think Again by, you know, Adam Grant. And your book just kind of came at a time that I was all into the whole idea of brain science. And I know we're going to dig into Powerful Teaching, because I think it is one of those must reads for educators. But before we dig into that, I just wanted to let you know what a positive impact your work has had on me.
Thank you so much, Shannon. That means a lot.
So I'm really fascinated by origin stories. How did you get into education? What's your role in education now?
Shannon, I have been on many podcasts, and you might be surprised to know I have rarely been asked this question, because I didn't just become a teacher right away.
Okay.
In fact, I had been a counselor, and I worked with different populations throughout the United States, in Chicago and Honolulu and Nashville, Tennessee. And then I got to St. Louis and I had started an outpatient program for, this is a long term here, for pediatrics and adolescents with chemical dependency and stress backgrounds. So most of my clients that I worked with were either chemically dependent or had made suicide attempts, were in gangs. And what I found is I connected so well with every single one. And I developed such a good repertoire with them. And I decided, what if each of these kids had had that one teacher in their life that they connected with before they ever got to that point? And so, I already was married and had very, very young children, ages, well, under the age of 5. And I quit that job and went back to school and became a teacher.
That's so
And
awesome.
I think one of my gifts, something that meant so much to me, is how well I really connected with those struggling students. And I was able to maintain good relationships, but it also led me to ask the question, why do some of my students learn really well and some not? And that's what led me into this whole new realm of
Yeah.
research.
I love that because it sounds to me that connection played a huge part, right? Like
It
actually
really
getting
did.
to know these kids at a deeper level rather than just looking at as like from the academic or a more superficial level, right? So
Right.
what was it about you? What was the gift when you, if you were to put a mirror up to yourself right now, Patrice, what was the gift that you were able to connect with these kids?
Oh, I wish I knew. I really have no idea. It was just something innate. I can't identify it, but I guess a gift is just being able to realize the inherent worth of every single human being. And I think when you are able to look at people, especially your students, and know that each one is a gift. As I said, I had very young children, and I knew looking at these pediatrics and adolescents, they were somebody's child, And that love that I felt for my own children was something that I could relate. I could see them as the young children that I wanted to care for.
It sounds to me that your gifts are compassion and empathy, if I may be so bold from, the 20,000 feet kind of point of view. So my trajectory is a lot different. So I've been teacher for 26 years and I'm in Prince George, British Columbia, Canada. And I'm an English and drama teacher by trade. But here's the thing, and this is where I connect with your story so well. On my trajectory in those early days where it felt like jobs were like dog eat dog, you grabbed a hold of anything. If someone reached out and said, "Here, please teach foods," which I did for a semester because you just did what you could to get your foot in the door. One of the contracts I received was actually to teach students with special or extraordinary needs. And where I connect with you is that. First of all, I was freaking out when I did that position because I didn't feel like I had the skill set. But like you, I think I was naturally driven to get to know the whole child. And what I learned from those students is that they're all on their own path. And if we can just see that, all students can learn at high levels.
Yes.
Sometimes they need to have and their own goals. That I think changed the way I taught forever. Like I think it actually made me a better teacher teaching these kids that might only be learning how to, ABCs and reading, C Spot Run and but to watch them reach their goals. As and then to skip over and teach like an honors grade 10 English class and see them work at high levels and reach their goals. They're in essence one and the same.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Looking at the whole child. So
Yes.
that's incredible. That's incredible. So how did you and Pooja come up with this? Like, what, how did you conceive and birth this beautiful book called Powerful Teaching?
Well, it started before I ever even met Pooja. I had a wonderful chance meeting with Dr. Mark McDaniel, who came to Washington University in St. Louis for the purpose of studying memory. And I had been teaching for about, 10, 12 years and was very frustrated. I already had a master's degree, an education specialist degree. I was adjunct faculty at two universities along with my teaching. And yet I didn't know the answer to how we learn. In 2006, the research that had been done on learning was all done in universities with college students in laboratories. That's not that long ago. And it had never been done in an authentic classroom. So I met Mark McDaniel and we were talking, and I was talking about my frustrations of, there was research, but I had no access to it. It was all in ivory towers. And even though I had advanced degrees in jargon, I couldn't really read. And, he was talking about his research on memory, and it just was kind of like a light bulb moment in that memory, being able to remember things. There's a connection here. And so we had this wonderful conversation. And then later, he introduced me to Dr. Henry Roediger. They are two of the authors of Make It Stick, which is another fabulous book.
Love it.
And we just had wonderful conversations. They would come over to our house out in the country, and we'd get glasses of wine and sit on the deck and talk about learning. Who gets to have opportunities like that, right? And
Yep, you got to milk it for all it's worth.
and so one day we were sitting there talking, and it was as if a balloon popped above our heads, or a light bulb went off above our heads. And I don't remember if it was Mark or Roddy who said, we should research how kids learn in a classroom. And I'm like, why, yes, we should. And I've got just the classroom.
Mine.
And so
Yours.
it took a lot of behind the scenes work. They got a large grant through the Institute of Educational Science, IES, which is an arm of the Department of Education, the US department. And I worked with my superintendent and principal, and we got all of it together, the funding, the approvals. I had to get approvals from all of my students' parents. But something that was profound to me was my superintendent asked me, Patrice, why do you even want to do this? And I so remember with such conviction saying, because I want to know how my students learn. And that was always my basis for everything that happened. So all this was in place, and at the time, Pooja Agarwal was working on her doctorate and was a research assistant at Washington University. And so she got hired on to help me in my classroom and devise the research. So for an entire semester, 18 weeks, Pooja sat in my classroom simply observing. Because another thing my superintendent said was, I will approve this as long as your teaching does not change. The research needs to support your teaching. Your teaching does not change according to the research, which, wow, that was really something because too often researchers come in and they
Right.
want you to do this and they want you to do that.
Yep.
But no. So back to, so Pooja just sat in my classroom for an entire 18 weeks, all day, every day, just observing, you know, seeing how she was so familiar with learning at the university level, what kinds of things would need to happen in a middle school classroom. So we would meet, you know, once or twice a week and discuss what she saw and discuss just kind of how to go about it. And Doctors McDaniel and Roediger were so generous and thoughtful and really let us figure out what we thought would work best in my classroom. And you know, how rare is that?
No
So,
kidding.
you know, we came up with ideas and then Pooja would run them by Doctors McDaniel and Roediger, and we devised a plan. So then the following semester is when the research actually began in my classroom. And that was in 2007. And powerful teaching didn't come out till 2019,
Right.
12 years
Wow.
later.
Holy, oh, okay.
Because, you know, I'd like to, when I give presentations, I like to say, have you ever had a seat at the table, not even realizing that a revolution is beginning? And not in our naivete, not realizing until years later the enormity of what happened in that classroom. Well, that was me with this learning revolution. I was so busy teaching. You know, I was one of those that put in 60, 70 hours a week teaching. I didn't have time to think about anything else. I was teaching, doing the research. And then around 2015, Dr. Agarwal and I, she was already living in Boston, and but we've been great friends ever since. We thought, you know, this is really an incredible journey that we've had. It took all those years to really look back and say, we need to document this. And I've always thought that the success of my students never was because of me as the teacher. It was because of the research and the strategies I developed that enabled kids to really learn. And so I wanted this book to be out there so teachers everywhere can do the same thing, see the same success, see the same light bulbs go off in their students' eyes as I got to see in mine.
So you learned from the researchers, or was it, these are what I've already been, this is what I've already been doing well, document. Now I'm going to make a change the following year, document some more. Is that essentially what happened? Like
Yes.
your actual teaching process evolved over years and years
Yes.
as a result of the research, not in spite of the research.
Yes,
Oh,
absolutely.
cool.
And you
Okay.
know, you're a teacher, Shannon. You know, being a good teacher, that There are some things that just feel right. You know they work, but you might not be sure why they work. And so part of the research, and again, back to Pooja sitting in my classroom every day for 18 weeks, she got to see how things worked. But I didn't know why they worked. And because of the research, I was able to figure out number one, why they work, and number two, how to be really intentional and purposeful. Because when your intuition comes forth, you might remember it on Tuesday, but you might forget all about it on Friday. You know, oh, that worked, but I'm trying something else now. So the research really helped me to hone my skill to why I developed the strategies and where to use them and how to be intentional and purposeful in using them.
Reflection and this lifelong learning passion that I think you and I both share is they're such gifts.
Yes.
Such powerful gifts. But I what resonated with me, what you just said is I felt that way reading Powerful Teaching, where there you're right, some things just click in the classroom, but you don't know why. So I had both things. I read the book and I went, oh, that's why that works. This is why I noticed that with my students. And then, oh, I think, okay, this is where I think I'm erring a bit. This is what I need to tweak. I like that, right? So some of the things I'd already been doing, you're right, like they just I felt like it reinforced it, okay? And then some things that were like, okay, these are the shifts I need to make, right? And I know sometimes like we slip back into the old habits, right? Like I find myself actually, and this is for listeners, you know, grab a copy of this book because you know in when I first listened to Powerful Teaching on Audible. It was during the pandemic, and I was having a hard time reading. My focus was off, and I just kept rewinding and listening and rewinding and listening. And then I realized I gotta stop rewinding and listening and just buy the damn book so I can write all over it and realize it. But okay, so now I want to dig in. I want to dig into the book, and I know that like there's. You know, you got their big aspects, the four big aspects, the focal points of the book. And I'm wondering if you would mind kind of giving us a little tour of each of the four, right? So we've got retrieval practice, spacing, interleaving, and feedback-driven metacognition, which listeners are all intuitive, right? You will get this. Okay. So are you ready? You're going to take us on a little tour of the book.
I'm ready.
Okay. So tell me about retrieval practice. What essence, what is that?
I'm going to back up even a little bit before that.
Sure.
If we talk about learning, there are basically three steps: encoding. And encoding is getting information into our heads. And as teachers, this is where we excel. We know our curriculum. We know what needs to be taught. We know what's on our tests. We know what they need to know for the coming year. We have hundreds, most likely, ways of getting this information into our students' heads. We excel at this. So that first step is encoding, getting information in. The second step is storage. We teach it and into the head it goes. And too often our teacher ed programs have stopped at that point. It's as if we've taught it, it's there, move on. But Dr. Agarwal has this wonderful quote in Powerful Teaching that says, too often we focus on getting information into our heads. What if instead we focused on pulling information out? And that third step is retrieval, encoding, getting it in, storage, it's there, and retrieval, pulling it out, being able to access that information when we need it. So the four power tools, retrieval is that power tool of being able to access in our long-term memory the information that we have learned. Power tool number one, retrieval. Power tool number two is spacing. Spacing is spaced retrieval. It's often called that too. It turns out, and this is like every teacher just wants to cover their ears and say, no, because as soon as we learn something, we start forgetting it.
Yes,
And
yes.
it's the way we learn.
Yeah,
We can't
it's our
do.
brains are like a sieve, right? It just
Yes.
starts leaking
And,
out.
you know, with all those hundreds of ways we have of encoding, you mean what, it's all for naught? But no. So there is something called the forgetting curve. And one of the best visuals I've ever seen is you can Google this, Doug Lamov's annotated forgetting curve. Just Google that, and this wonderful infographic comes up. But what happens when we talk about the forgetting curve is when we realize that forgetting is a part of learning. So rather than forgetting everything, forget a little bit and then boom, retrieve it again. Because that is what strengthens those memories. And that is spacing. So the first power tool is retrieval, pulling information out. The second is spacing, space practice, which is ensuring that you use retrieval at optimum times.
So you've got to take these moments to make sure you keep coming back to it, right?
Yes.
Otherwise, because I know I'm thinking about my own high school, and and that's like, back in the, late 80s. And I would go into a class, I would learn something, I would take notes. The next day we'd have a quiz. Sometimes we would do corrections, and then we'd move on to the next thing, right? Move on to the next thing, move on to the next thing. It was like lather, rinse, repeat, lather, rinse, repeat. And then it wasn't until the end of the course that we got, some kind of a final exam, right? Right. And so what do kids do, right? Like my own kids, right? My daughter's 19, my son's, 24. When they were in high school, they cram it all in, right? Because they have to for that final exam. And like you said, the art of forgetting, 2 days later, they can't remember a damn thing.
That's exactly right. And
Right?
how often is that what we did in our high school
Yep.
years, in our college years? You know, we cram the night before. And why do we cram? Because it helps the next day on the test.
Oh,
But like you
because it
said,
works, right? Yeah,
it
it
works,
works.
but then it's gone. And that's why so many of us cannot remember a thing that we learned.
Yeah. See, and this is why, with my assessment background, Patrice, I sometimes will get recognized as the person who is anti-test. I'm like, I'm not anti-test. I just think that maybe traditionally the way I took tests doesn't help me actually, doesn't equate to the learning process.
Exactly.
Right. And
Exactly.
I mean, I can make a case for the fact that it's not nearly as enjoyable as doing a project, but that's another podcast. Right. But at the same time, have the tests, have those kinds of quizzing, because that's when you talk about retrieval practice and space practice, you talk about using quizzing,
Oh, yeah.
routine, low or no stakes quizzing in order to do that. Can you touch on that idea of how does the quizzing look like? Can you give me some kind of a little example, or listeners an example of what that might look like?
I can. But before that, let me get to a third power tool, and
Okay, sure.
that
Yeah.
is metacognition. We labeled it as feedback-driven metacognition. And Shannon, this ties in a lot with what you were already talking about. How often have we taught something and not gone over it until that final exam? We haven't allowed our students those opportunities to test what they know versus what they don't know before they get to that big exam. And so metacognition, that's what it is, discriminating what you know versus what you don't know. Very easy. And it's vital that we give feedback so the students know whether they're on the right track or not.
And
So now when,
so we know they're on the right track, right? This is formative assessment, right? It's let's see if it's stuck, right? Keep coming back to it.
So retrieval, spacing, and metacognition, the three of them truly go hand in hand because we want our students to retrieve information. We want to space it out so the information, they can retain that information. But we must, throughout the courses of study, give the students the opportunity to know whether they know it or not. And to me, errors are a cause for celebration. You know, it's not where the floor should open up and you fall in with embarrassment, but instead, errors are like a roadmap that, oh, I need to go that way and go back and review it. So now back to quizzing. Roundabout way of getting there.
No, that's perfect.
So I often started my classes with a mini quiz. And what is a mini quiz? I would take whatever we had discussed the day before, what might have been homework, cut it up in little clues and stuck it in a basket. And we would begin the class with, I would randomly choose five. By the way, I had six classes. Towards probably 2014 on, I usually had about 180 students every day. And I had been one of those teachers, I'm sorry, who would give homework and felt it was so important they got the homework back the next day. So I would spend 2 hours grading over 180 pieces of homework every night, giving it back the next day, and realizing I would see them in the trash. And it didn't mean anything. And I realized my homework was just not working for my students or for me. So that's when I came up with the idea of these mini quizzes. And it was simple. What, like I said, whatever we talked about, what would have been homework, I cut it up because I quit giving homework. Not everybody can do
Oh,
that, but I did
I do
because
it. I don't give homework.
it wasn't effective for
No,
me.
it's not. Well, and it can be this points driven. Percentages, driven by the students, and that's all that they're trying to grasp at is, if it's worth like 10% or 15% in the grade book, I'll just do it. And sometimes they would cheat. They'd stand at each other's lockers and just copy because they knew if they did it and handed in, got 100%, or a completion mark or something like that, they got the points, right?
So instead, I gave these little mini quizzes. I called them mini because I would give them little cut up 2 by inch, 3 inch, 2 by 3 inch pieces of recycled paper. They would number 1 through 5. And I would simply read a clue. They would write an answer. When we finished all five, they would turn them in. I would go over what the answers were. And this, I don't think ever took more than 4 or 5 minutes total from start to finish, maybe not even that long.
Because you just skimmed the answers just to kind of get a snapshot of how they did.
Well, I would give feedback as soon as they turned it in and discuss why the answers were correct, giving elaborative feedback. But my over 2 hour nights of grading turned into a quick 15-minute analysis after school. I could just look at those. And if they got something wrong, I would circle it. If they got everything right, a happy face, boom. And then I would give them back the next day. And I would go over the answers once again because that was spacing out the retrieval. And what I realized is students started listening really differently because they knew whatever we were discussing would probably be on the mini quiz the next day. And Our discussions got richer and deeper in class. The mini quizzes were non-stressful. It helped that they were on tiny little pieces of paper. It helped there was no grade on it, just a happy face. It helped if things were circled because by this time I had taught them all about metacognition and they realized, oh, well, that's where I need to work. Here's a fun little story. I had a mom come in for parent-teacher conference. She wasn't happy. And she said, Mrs. Bain, my son does not do well on these mini quizzes. And I asked him, why? You get these quizzes every day. Why aren't you doing well on these? And she said, do you know what he said to me? He said, oh, Mom, don't worry about it. It's just my metacognition telling me I couldn't retrieve it yet.
How
11.
old is he? Oh, that's
And
beautiful.
his mom looked at me and said, what kind of an answer was that? And I said, oh, the very best kind. And pulled out the grade book. He had 100% on every single test. And so when we offer our students those opportunities to retrieve, to space it out, to give them the opportunity to test their metacognition, this is why it's lower, no stakes. They don't have to feel badly if they missed it. Instead, it gives them that roadmap of where they need to study.
Nice.
So, does it have to be a quiz? No, it could be an entrance ticket. It could be as simple as, and I would do these all the time as well, a quick turn and talk. I would ask
Yep.
a question,
Yep.
turn and talk to your neighbor, get three people to answer, talk about it, 90 seconds. You
Yeah.
have a room rich with retrieval.
Yeah.
Simple things teachers can do. So often we encode, we say, okay, class, remember yesterday we talked about blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
Last week we talked about blah, 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 blah. Just changing that to, hi, class, what did we talk about yesterday? Turn and talk
Yes.
to your neighbor. Give them 15 seconds, do a group share. Again, within 90 seconds, you have a room full of retrieval. You have spaced it, you've allowed metacognition. And so these power tools, they don't take a lot of time. But
That's
doing
and
it.
that's I think that's a really important nugget there. They don't take a lot of time because I
Yeah.
think one of the thing that sometimes feels threatening for educators is if they see that there's something that feels like maybe new or novel, I don't have time for that,
Yes, here's
right?
one more
This is
thing.
actually going to save you time, I think, in the future.
Oh, it totally does
You're not
because
marking homework. Like, you know.
that. But also think about when you give those chapter tests and the unit tests and the final tests, how much time you have to spend on review. You don't have to spend time on review when they already know the information before you get to the test. And that's what you want. You don't want them cramming where they're going to forget it. You want them to be able to have access, to have links to all this information so they can use the information. We work way too hard as teachers to spend all these hours teaching to only have our students forget.
And I think you're teaching them how to study. Like you're teaching them how the brain works and how they're going to be able to remember. Like too often I will hear educators say, I believe in the importance of a test because in life there are tests, so that's why I'm going to give you this test. Meanwhile, you know, or you need to learn how to study. Right. That's why I'm giving you a test. And it's like,
Shannon,
yeah, but you're
I.
not teaching them how to study. Like, you're not even, you
But
know,
those are
like,
also true statements because just because I use low stakes and no stakes didn't mean I didn't have high stakes tests
That's
and
right.
projects and essays and papers. I did. So there's still that opportunity. And yes, students need to know how to take a test, but we don't have to blindside them.
That's right. It doesn't have to trick them or, you know, where they,
Yeah.
you know, hit the pothole and
Yeah.
They feel like they're not, they feel like kids are, we're living in a world right now where kids are so disconnected, right? And they're glued to their phones. And, you know, I also see this as a really powerful way to connect with kids and have them feel the success that often, tests can make them feel unsuccessful or unworthy or stupid or failures, right?
Yes. So here's another story. I always started every single first day with, I'm your teacher and I'm going to teach you how to learn. Because I felt too often, especially for struggling students, that learning was like this huge invitation, a huge invitation to learning. And the struggling students never got the invitation. And when we teach all of our kids how to learn, whether they are a struggling student, whether they are in special education classes, whether they are labeled as gifted, every single student can benefit from learning how to learn. Too often, this would happen every single year at the end of first quarter, I would have students come in and say, Mrs. Payne, I have an A or I have a B in your class. And I would always like, I know.
Yeah,
I
I'm the
grade
one
your
who put
papers,
it
I
in there.
know.
Yeah.
And they were doing well, but their whole demeanor would change and they would say, but I never do well. And would say, I always get D's and F's. And you would see them absolutely slump and say, I'm not smart. And I would gather all my enthusiasm and say, but look at you now. The only difference is now you're learning how to learn. That's the only difference. You are you and you are successful. And these same students would absolutely be soaring because once they got these really great grades in my classroom, they liked how it felt and they would start applying these strategies in other classrooms. And I kept thinking, how can we have educational systems where students internalize failure by the time they are 11 years old? And all it takes is for us as teachers to teach them how to learn and how their entire life can change. You know, if they're not saddled with frustration when they're in high school, when they are not feeling like they have been defeated, give them the tools that we know exist that are at our fingertips that allow these kids, no matter their background, to be successful.
Oh, you are speaking my language, lady, as a person, especially who's really passionate about standards-based grading and learning, especially the learning part. This is why powerful teaching just works so nicely, so in tandem, because grading on the using the standards to grade and just taking their recent or most be their best evidence of learn the most recent evidence of learning and dismissing the rest because it's learning takes time. That honors the learner, but at the same time, you also need strategies like these powerful teaching tools to get there, right? A grading, a style of grading isn't what's actually going to result in the high levels of achievement. It has to work in tandem with these kinds of power tools. Now, I want to back up just ever so slightly, if I may. Using these power tools and doing these kind of quizzing, this doesn't work just exclusively for like typical like content pieces, right? Like definitions and dates and who did this and what did they do, kind of puking up whatever was in a textbook, for example. This can also be used for processes and skills, right? Like competency-based type activities, correct?
Absolutely. You brought up an important point because sometimes people will equate retrieval with regurgitation of facts. And it is so much more than that. And part of it is we don't have to, as teachers, We do not have to limit the questions we ask to simple recall. Use higher order thinking, use deep thinking when we ask our questions. The fourth power tool I did not yet get to was interleaving. And so this ties in real well with this conversation. Interleaving is really what promotes the deep thinking, the critical thinking. And it's, you can define it by comparing and contrasting similar content. So once I was working with a teacher and she said, "So I'm a science teacher and I can, are you saying I would just combine biology with chemistry?" And I said, "No, that's not it." And I gave a little example. Interleaving is kind of like making a fruit salad. You can put in bananas and grapes and oranges, but you would not throw in a tomato, even though a tomato is a fruit. It's like, ew, that doesn't go there. In interleaving, we want to have a fruit salad without the tomato. Now, how did I achieve this in my world history classroom? I used essential questions. So whenever we had a new chapter or a new unit, I had an essential question on the board. For example, when I taught the ancient river civilizations, my essential question, which stayed on the board throughout that entire unit, was, how did flooding affect the ancient river civilizations? So when we talked about the Nile, they learned they could regurgitate, facts about the Nile and where it's located. But I could also get them to understand about the flooding that occurred in the Nile and how actually positive it was and how they created systems. They actually built cubits, kind of like stairs, and a cubit is from your elbow to the tip of your finger. They put these on the steps so when it flooded, they knew how high the water went and how much water they would have to plant the crops, to have for the crops the following year. So they used flooding in a great way. And then we would go on to the Tigris and Euphrates, and we would find out that in some of the ancient river civilizations, they had no idea when it was going to flood and civilizations were destroyed. So by the end of studying all of the ancient river civilizations, I would give my students an essay question of the essential question: how did flooding impact ancient river civilizations? And they could take each of them, the Nile, the Hwang, the Indus, the Tigris and Euphrates, and write this essay on how flooding was affected in every single one. That's not regurgitation of facts. That is weaving together information that answers critical thinking. And
Oh, I love
that's
it.
interleaving. That's what we want to do. We need to teach the facts. The students need the facts in order to take it to higher levels.
Yeah.
So when you combine the retrieval and the spacing and the interleaving and the feedback-driven metacognition, you have learning.
It's magic. Okay, so my brain is like I'm firing off on all cylinders. So in British Columbia, our standards are comprised of competencies, curricular competencies, and content. Okay, so the content, instead of just assessing or evaluating the content and making that the focal point of our grade books, the content's actually driving these competencies, and these are high order thinking skills. A lot of our competencies are we're asking them to synthesize, to analyze, to create, to assess or evaluate. So when I think about, for example, and we're assessing these competencies as opposed to exclusively, or sorry, evaluating for report cards, these competencies versus the content. Okay, so that's the 30-second version of that. But where I'm seeing the interleaving work so beautifully is If my goal is to have my students become really good at, say, social studies eight, they need to learn how to do cause and consequence, right? And have cause and consequences. They need to make those, short-term change. What are the immediate consequences, right? What are the, initial causes? And then they get longer. We talk about long-term change. And then we talk about how, they interconnect. So while the goal at the start, while I'm showing them this, might be we're doing it, say, for the fall of Rome. Now, interleaving, as we were working through Charlemagne and the Merovingians and the start of feudalism, we're coming back to cause and consequence, right? I've already taught them how to do this. I'm bringing in that new content, and they're still working on that skill. So it's not one and done, right? We're not just taking that competency. Oh, I did it for the fall of Rome. Done. Check off that box. Keep lapping it over and over. And our curriculum, we got some beautiful curriculum, Patrice. I'm telling you got to take a look at it. It is beautiful. Like, and I'm not just saying that. We're starting to be recognized as having this fantastic curriculum because of the competencies. But anyway, I digress. It's not like I created it or anything, right? But then that lapping and over and over again. So they're focused and they're learning that content. And that's where I would do these little mini quizzes. But at the same time, I'd also be thinking about how can I also assess those competencies as mini quizzes too, right? Okay, you've learned cause and consequence, okay? Tell me give me two short-term consequences for Clovis the First, as a Merovingian, as a Frankish ruler. And they're thinking, and they have to actually think. I didn't give them that answer the day before. I talked about the Merovingians, but I didn't give them that answer, and they just have to regurgitate it. They have to think, okay, I used that process in the last unit. Now I need to try to do that again. And then I'm getting that formative feedback to see whether or not it's sticking. Oh,
Isn't that wonderful?
so awesome.
So, one of my just I was I loved doing this. At the end of the year, I would give an essay. And my curriculum was world history, and part of that included, the history of different countries, religious backgrounds, just, the gamut. And so at the end of the year, I would give my students an essay question. Keep in mind they are 11 years old. And I would ask this question: given countries A and B, whichever, I'd, pick them out of a hat, ones that we had studied. Thinking of their historical and religious backgrounds, what would be the ramifications if either one or both had nuclear power capabilities? All of my students, regardless of ability levels, were able to write an essay on that question.
That's so awesome. They're learning at high levels. Like, that's beautiful.
Yes, that's, and it's not like they crammed the night before for an exam and forgot it. What kind of critical thinking does that promote, that as they advance their educational careers, they can be thinking about topics like that when they listen to the news? We learned about things like that. What does that do for future critical thinking when we can enable this type of learning with our students?
What do you say? And I think I already know the answer to it, but I'm going to ask it anyways, because as me being the assessment geek, what do you say to educators who struggle with the idea of giving these kinds of like mini quizzes and that kind of thing that are low stakes or no stakes, where they have this point of view that their kids are not going to do it unless I mark it, unless it's worth mega points? They won't care, Patrice. They're not going to care if I don't supply points for it. How do you view that through a powerful teaching lens?
That is such a common question and such a common concern. And there was a time when I probably thought the same thing.
Me too.
But what I realized through the years of research that I conducted in my classroom was that it truly is a process. And I wouldn't begin with the low stakes and no stakes that related to curriculum right away. My first task is teaching my students how to learn. And I would begin on day one using whiteboards with questions where no one could fail, such as, what's the latest you slept over the summer? Or what's your least favorite school lunch? Write it down, share it with your neighbor. I'm getting them used to writing on whiteboards, doing turn and talks, and doing group shares. And I explain, you just retrieved. So I teach all about how to retrieve before I ever get to the curriculum.
Nice.
And then I would give them some sample mini quizzes and just say, there's no grade on this. How'd you do? Where do you need to focus your time? And so, students, especially by the time they take their first test and they realize they didn't have to really study very hard for it because they already knew the information. By the time that first test is given in September, you already had so much buy-in.
Yeah, because I mean, it's such a myth that kids won't buy in unless there's points. I mean, there is a culture of points-driven assessment, but what I love about what you just said is you have to talk about these things with the kids. You have to explain that, this is the Embrace the Messy podcast. Learning is messy, right? Teaching is messy. Learning is messy. And there is something really beautiful when I know when I talk to my students, even as they get older, like grade 10, 11, and 12, that to actually say that learning is messy and that I know that there is also this, stigma and pressure and anxiety around percentages and letter grades. What if we just cut out all the middlemen and just, really focus on what does learning mean and how can we work together so that you become really great at this? And then, my assessment is going to be where I stand back and use my professional judgment and go, what has evolved over time? What has your learning been over time? Instead of penalizing you for not knowing something on the first day, right? Because, it depends on kids' entry points like that. Some kids are more privileged than others, right? They have access to these resources. They've come from maybe a school, maybe where they already know how to do this. So they are then automatically rewarded on the first quizzes that are worth points versus the student who didn't have that access. And now that's going to hold them down, keep them down, and they actually have to try to, swim upstream and kind of recover from those points,
Exactly. And something else I think
or
is,
losing those points, I should say.
Dan Willingham has a great quote, which is, children are more alike than different in terms of how they think and learn. To me, that's so powerful. I'm going to say it again. Children are more alike than different in terms of how they think and learn. And when you tell that to a group of students, you can see some of the struggling students go, wait, I learn the same way as he does, as she does, and they get really good grades. And the answer is yes, you learn the same way. Let me show you the strategies that are going to help you be successful.
So, Patrice, when I emailed you about coming on the podcast, I was really excited to learn that in addition to Powerful Teaching, and there is another book for parents, Powerful Teaching for Parents. Did I get the title right? You have a new book coming out, which is connected to both of those, right? Tell us about this book and when is it going to be available for really eager people like me?
Oh, Shannon, I am so, I don't think I've ever been this excited for a book. It's due to the publisher in less than 2 weeks. So I am frantically trying to get it done. We're still not quite sure the title, but we think it's going to be Powerful Learning. It is Powerful Learning, Strategies and Resources. It is a companion book to Powerful Teaching. But here's how it started. I am so fortunate that people all over have embraced Powerful Teaching. And I frequently on social media would see somebody posting a strategy and tagging me, and you know, it happened here and happened there. And I would bookmark it, I would copy and paste it and save it. And last summer I realized I can't find any of these. You know, where are they all? And so I thought, I'm just going to stop and put them all in one place.
Nice.
And as I was doing that, I realized, wait a minute, if I want them in one place, maybe other people would like them in one place too. Aha. And so the idea was born of creating a book that not only has my strategies, but strategies that people around the world have created based on powerful teaching. And so I have teachers from all over who have used this. I have feedback from Kazakhstan and Poland and Sweden and Australia, New Zealand, and you name it. I have feedback from them. So I thought, okay, I'm going to put these strategies together. And then I thought, well, I should probably add a little bit about how the research came to be. Really, in my words, in Powerful Teaching, it's a combination of both Dr. Agarwal's and mine. But let's do it all in layman's terms. You know, what is it like as a teacher? So I did that. And then I had another thought, and that was, well, what about administrators? How do you bring the science of
Yes.
learning to your school and
Yeah.
maintain it? And
So
then I thought of
important. Yeah.
instructional coaches. Well, how do you incorporate the science of learning with those you coach? So that became a section. And then I started thinking of the many people who have influenced me. And I thought, what if I wrote to these people and asked, who influences you? What a fascinating question that could be. So I did. I asked them three questions. One, of your own work, articles, blogs, podcasts, books, papers, whatever. What is your favorite and why? And the second question, what are three of other people's works? What are three that you would recommend? And then the last question was, who influences you? And the feedback, Shannon, I cannot believe it. I get goosebumps. Of course, Dr. Mark McDaniel and Dr. Henry Roediger and Dr. Pooja Agarwal, but also Dan Willingham and Barbara Oakley and Zach Groeschel and Blake Harvard and Tom Sherrington and Oliver Caviglioli and Kate Jones and Anna Stokey. Did I say her name right?
I don't know.
She's a fellow Canadian,
Oh, okay.
Stokke, who has a wonderful podcast on math. And I was on
Nice.
her podcast talking about
Oh, okay. I know who you're talking
how
about
they're
now.
teaching math. So I have people from all over who graciously answered my question. So this book to me is my ultimate gift because it talks about the research. It has great strategies. It has information about administrators and coaches and so many resources from influencers. And best of all, I encourage people to write in the book.
Nice, nice,
You know,
nice.
I want it dog-eared, and I want it written on, and I want it,
It
you
needs to
know.
be messy.
Yes,
It's
this
gotta
is
get
your
messy.
messy book.
Woohoo!
You know, powerful teaching, you can keep that kind of pristine, but I'm a teacher and I want you to get messy with it.
Nice. Well, you are
Oh,
speaking
and
to my heart.
it comes out in October.
Okay, I was gonna ask that. I was gonna ask that. And you know, if you need anyone to give it a read in order to
Shannon.
review it before it comes out, you, honey, I'm your gal.
I'm writing it
You,
down right now.
woohoo,
We have
you let me
three.
know. Let me know. Okay, I'm telling you. Oh man, I love talking about this stuff. I just it
Me
you've
too.
had such an impact. But we're going to end with what I call the elevator pitch. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. So, elevator pitch is what I do with all of my guests. I'm going to ask you a question, and the idea is that someone's going to get on the elevator with you, and within the span of just going up three floors, you have to be able to give them an idea on how you can approach and answer the question. All right, so here is what it is. Okay, an educator gets on an elevator with you on floor number three. Just as they hit the button for floor six, they tell you that they're struggling with the amount of test anxiety their students seem to have. They give unit tests and kids skip their class or freeze. What might you tell them to try that could reduce the text anxiety that students feel?
I would share the story I already shared with you about the students who would say, I have an A or I have a B, and say, the whole secret is teaching our students how to learn. The information is at our fingertips. You will change your students' lives. It's simple, it's accessible. We can do it.
Yeah. Well, Patrice, you've changed my life. You've
Oh, Shannon.
changed the way I've taught, and you've reinforced some of the strategies I know work really, really well. And I just can't emphasize the listeners enough that this is a really important book. It's a really accessible, intuitive book, and I'm super excited for your next book. And thank you so much for joining me and helping all of us understanding the importance of learning with our beautiful kids.
Shannon, it has just been a delight. I feel like I've met another kindred spirit. It's as if we're sitting over a cup of coffee talking about some of our favorite things. So thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm honored to have produced this and all episodes of the Embrace the Messy podcast with Shannon Schinkel on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Tlalitne First Nation. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and share it with a colleague or friend. Doing so will help others find the podcast. Know someone who embraces the messy and would make a great guest on the pod? Email me at embracethemessypodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.